Hey, folks, I've got a special guest interviewer for you today. Not a guest, a special guest interviewer. And Jamile Carol Jones, good acupuncturist friend of mine, is here today to be your guest interviewer. She has a long time connection with someone you may have heard of, Lorraine Wilcox. And Jamile, how did you first meet her?
We met almost 40 years ago, which is unbelievable to me, when we were both working at National Public Radio. We were both new hires. We started around the same time. And Lorraine was a recording engineer, and she was working with All Things Considered. And I was on the production staff of a brand new show called Morning Edition. And at that time, recording engineers and producers worked really closely. We, as producers, depended a lot on the recording engineers to make our work sound good. So there were many times when I had to put a report together with the help of an engineer, and Lorraine was that person in the studio, or either sometimes I remember she would take in audio feeds of news reports from reporters and producers who were in the field, and I had to put them together for the shows. And so we had a lot of interaction just about radio. And at that time, I was barely a teenager, but I had no inclination of doing anything else but radio. I loved it. I was totally addicted to producing pieces for radio. And I never imagined that at this point, we'd be talking about Chinese medicine.
40 years down the road.
Yeah. And when I heard that she had gone to acupuncture school and had done teaching and writing, I started reading her articles. And it was before I had really decided to go to school. But Lorraine was like a light for me because it felt like it might be something impossible to do. Or I felt that I should just continue with my chosen career. But I got a lot of inspiration to go ahead and do what was calling me from watching her.
Well, that's fantastic. I am looking forward to the conversation that you two are about to have.
I remember what year it was, and I think we both started working at NPR around the same time. And
I started the year Morning Edition started. I started just in like the months before it came online, although I never worked for Morning Edition.
Yeah, no, I did work for them, and I started in 79. And at the time, it was my first experience working with recording engineers, because when I, in my previous radio experience, producers had to do everything. But at that time, it was great to be able to bring all the elements of my piece, my report I was putting together, and then just collaborate with you. I remember I had good experiences working with you.
Really? Because I was such a grouch.
We all were. It was the middle of the night.
And I had so much liver chi. I didn't know it then, but
I didn't either. I think we all did. And the coffee was flowing and the sugar. And it was 2 o'clock in the morning and we were supposed to be running around like it was 9 or 10 in the morning, fully alert. And I think we all loved what we were doing, but we wondered why we were doing it and what was the sense of it. I know I did. But that's what led me to find an acupuncturist, because I was so ill in so many ways from that pace. So when you had that job, had you any awareness of Chinese medicine?
No, or none.
Any
none.
Interest?
No.
So then how did your interest evolve?
When I moved to Los Angeles, NPR hired me as the Los Angeles bureau engineer. And I came here, and after a while, I hated LA because I was used to DC. I lived at DuPont Circle. I could walk to work. I could walk to the metro. I could stick my finger up and get a taxi anywhere I wanted to. You know, I was an urban dweller, and I come to Los Angeles, and this is not a city like that. So I hated driving so much, and I started hating my job because when I worked at NPR in DC, you know, there was another shift so I could go home when my time was up. I didn't have to work overtime that often. But here I was the only bureau engineer. So if one of the reporters wasn't done, I had to stay until they were done. So I hated the job because I was at the mercy of the crazy reporters. You know, I wasn't getting along very well in my relationship, and I hated LA. And I just thought, I like learning stuff. I like reading. I like studying. I want to go to school just for myself, not to change career. Just I wanted something mine. And in looking around, I found, whoa, there are acupuncture schools here. There was just SAMRA, and I think Emperor's College had just started. And yeah, they started in 83, and I came here in 84. So I thought, that looks different. Why be normal, right?
Had you had acupuncture treatment before?
Never. So I went to the school just to see what it was. I went to SAMRA, and they offered me a free treatment. So that was my first acupuncture treatment when I was considering going to school. And I thought, this is interesting. I like that. So I signed up for basic theories class, just one class at night after work. And I fell in love with it from the beginning, which is actually surprising because the teacher wasn't very good. He was, you know, he didn't speak Chinese. He didn't read Chinese. And like whatever he didn't know, he filled in with weird stuff that wasn't necessarily Chinese medicine. But I didn't know he didn't know anything then. And I just fell in love with it. So after that, I was working full time and going to school full time at night. And it made my life much more manageable.
Yeah, busy though. And so you eventually just enrolled in a whole program and you dove deep. But you also, were you studying feng shui while you were in school, or was that after?
That was after. So when I graduated, I pretty quickly got bored with Chinese medicine because, you know, back then the schools, there were fewer good teachers and there were less books in English. And I kind of thought, is that all there is? So I got bored with it. And that's what I always do. All my life, I learn something like, you know, 80%, and then I get bored and go off to learn something else. So after I'd graduated, I just became interested in feng shui and astrology, Chinese astrology. And I found a teacher, and I didn't want to pay for the class. So I got him to teach at the acupuncture school. I was working in admin then. And so he came and taught at the school, and, you know, I got to go for free. And then I continued taking classes with him after that because I decided it was interesting. And so, yeah, that came later.
Did you have any interest at that time in treating patients or having a practice?
I didn't know that there was anything else I could do. I didn't read Chinese then. I just thought that's what you did. So the problem, I had some financial issues, and so I couldn't quit my day job. I couldn't really quit NPR at the time because my daughter was born 4 months before I graduated, and I had to have stable income and not start a real practice. But I started a little part-time practice, renting a room from an acupuncturist from Taiwan, and a couple days a week, maybe. And the thing is, I don't understand humans. So I don't know how to go up to people and say, hi, my name's Lorraine. I'm an acupuncturist. Oh, you know, I see you have this problem. Maybe I could help you with that. I just don't know how to interact with people like that. And so mostly I just like sat around in my little treatment room and didn't treat patients. It wasn't a very successful practice.
It sounds like your mind was busy with these other ideas of things you wanted to delve into.
One thing you can say about me is I always have a busy mind. Too busy. So I heard about, there was a clinic for people with HIV and AIDS. This was in maybe 1990. 1989, I don't know. And they were looking for volunteers. So I decided to volunteer there one afternoon a week. And it was just acupuncture, no herbs. It was in a Western medicine clinic, and we weren't allowed to do herbs or moxa. So I just was, you know, in this clinic, I didn't have to go looking for patients. Of course, I didn't get paid, but the patients were just there. And I liked it and I stuck with it. I volunteered for, I don't know how long, a couple of years. And then they hired me half time. And I'm much more suited, if I'm going to practice, to work in a place where they have a front desk and I get paid an hourly rate. And I really liked working with that particular clientele. And I felt, I went home at the end of the day feeling I had done something good for people who couldn't get served otherwise because they paid very little for treatment. It's much better than me having to go out and find patients.
Yeah. So at that time, being finished with school and practicing part-time and working full-time and having a small child, a new daughter.
Yeah.
Did you, it's amazing. Did you still have time for independent study or for pursuing topics or areas of study that you, that interested you?
At that time, I hadn't, you know, started studying Chinese yet. And so there, anytime there was a new book in English, I'd buy it, but there wasn't much to do. So I was mostly actually spending a lot of time with my feng shui teacher. And I don't think I was working full time then. Actually, I think by that time I'd quit NPR and was working at SAMHRA in administration. I was the so-called clinic coordinator for 3 years there, which was kind of a nightmare 3 years in terms of, I don't like working in administration, but I needed some stable income, you know, and so there was that. And, you know, taking feng shui classes and so forth.
Were you doing readings, feng shui readings or astrology readings for people?
Not so much because, well, for friends, because, you know, I, like I said, I just don't understand humans and I don't get how to interact with them. Well, that just isn't one of my strong suits. I'm just too, I don't know, straightforward and don't like any nonsense. And if you're in this some kind of service profession, you have to make nice with people, and I'm too liverish to want to make nice. So I was teaching for my feng shui teacher. He didn't really love teaching the beginning level classes. He would teach more advanced stuff and I'd teach beginning stuff. And I was teaching in the acupuncture schools and working in admin and doing the work at the HIV clinic. So out of those few things, I could make enough to pay the rent and keep my daughter with food and clothing.
Yeah. So I want to back up to the feng shui a little bit. What about that grabbed you about that work and what you were studying with your teacher? What was your teacher's name?
Larry Tsang from the American Feng Shui Institute. I guess I was attracted to the more esoteric nature of it. And I don't know, it just seemed more interesting at the time and more close to older Chinese stuff. I think I already kind of understood that I wasn't overly fond of TCM style, although I really didn't know much about the history of Chinese medicine. But I think if I had found the right teacher of Chinese medicine who had stuff that went a little deeper, I might have stayed with Chinese medicine at the time and been more enthusiastic about it.
Well, yeah, that's interesting because the reason I asked the question, you answered perfectly what I was thinking about, because as I've watched your work develop over 20 years and talked with you. And the thread that really runs through it is your interest and your focus on the tradition and not making things up, but really delving deep in the tradition and then bringing those ideas and practices forward and showing how they're still relevant and useful.
That's exactly what I like to do. You summarized it quite well.
Well, I would rather you talk about it than me. So like you have a real interest in the Ming Dynasty, right?
Yeah. Well, so as long as we're doing this ancient history, let me go back to, you know, I would buy every book that came out in English at the time. Now you can't do it anymore because there's so many books. But Blue Poppy Press with Bob Flaws was publishing some stuff that was more tradition-based rather than modern at the time. And then Bob Flaws had this book about translating modern medical Chinese or something like that. And he also was giving lectures about that. And that gave me somehow permission to like, oh, yeah, maybe I could learn some Chinese and try and poke around myself and see what I can find. Also, at the same time, my feng shui teacher, everybody wanted him to teach this kind of astrology called Zuwei Doshu. And he was saying, I don't know how to do this for English speakers. And the problem was, they're like, he uses 113 different stars and they all have names like Tianji or Tai Yin and Tai Yang or Wu Chu or whatever. And he didn't know how to put that into English. And I said, this was before I knew any Chinese. I said, well, that's just like the names of herbs, which I'm so used to from studying herbs. I could figure out the pinyin for that anyway. And so I bought a Chinese dictionary and I learned how to use it on my own. And this was before there was that much internet. It was before there was any internet. So I just figured out how to use the Chinese dictionary and I figured out how to get the pinyin for these stars. And I tried to translate their names and everything. And then Bob Flaws had this book about translating modern medical Chinese. And so I just started looking for old texts in Chinese and character by character trying to translate them. And when you do that, you only can kind of have a vague idea what they're talking about, but you can't really get any essence. But still, I suddenly felt like I had been, everything had been on a black and white TV, and now suddenly I had a color TV. It just felt so much more alive, like in The Wizard of Oz when she goes from the black and white part and suddenly Dorothy's not in Kansas anymore and it's all in Technicolor. And so even though I understood very little, but the little bits I could grasp just made it come alive, and that brought me back to medicine.
So you're saying you taught yourself how to read and translate characters and understand what was being written?
Little by little. I mean, I'm still teaching myself.
After doing several books of translated.
Yeah. And you know, you go back and look at that stuff and you see all the mistakes you made and you say, oh, but you know, I still think it's better to have a book that has a few mistakes in it translated than to have no books at all, you know, for other people.
I agree.
And so I've just persisted. And at that time, there was no internet and no electronic tools. And it was all, you know, I got so good at using dictionaries. And I found out that in Chinese, there's zidian, which means like a one character at a time dictionary. And then there's zidian, which is phrase dictionaries. And so when you start looking at phrases, you start finding sometimes things mean more than the two or three characters that make it up. And, you know, little by little, I got to understand more and more. I wasn't publishing at this time. And eventually I took like 3 semesters of Chinese at Santa Monica College, but it was horrible because it was all about like, where is the bathroom and where is my seat on this airplane? And there wasn't very much written and it was all modern and conversational, but it helped me somewhat with the grammar. Mm-hmm. And so just little by little, and now there's so many tools that you can buy and have in your cell phone or have on the internet, or which makes it much quicker. And also the interaction with, you know, some people, maybe some of the people here know Leo Locke is amazing and so helpful. So when I get stuck, I can ask him, and I have people in person that I can ask, Chinese speakers who do understand old medical Chinese, and, mm-hmm. you know, just little by little.
So would you recommend to, say, a new practitioner who wants to continue to study and be able to read older texts, would you recommend they do what you did now with the, I'm taking into account there's more tools available, but do you still think that's a good way to learn?
You know, so I don't believe in having regrets, but knowing what I know now, if I had a do-over, I would have studied classical Chinese in college before I went to acupuncture school. But I don't think that should be a requirement. I think there are only a special few people who this would be good for. And I would have started much earlier and I would have learned grammar correctly and everything, because like my grammar is not very good. And so sometimes you can make a translation error because you don't quite understand the grammar perfectly. But, you know, not everybody has time to go to college for classical Chinese or could even get into a school or has a school nearby. Besides that, there's some people who teach courses, and you need a certain amount of general Chinese as well as the specialized medical terminology. But I think people can teach themselves if they're persistent. I mean, I always joke, I don't do crossword puzzles and I don't watch TV. My entertainment is working with this stuff because I just love it so much. I'm always having that light bulb go off over my head when I come across some new concept and it suddenly makes sense. I just love this exploration. But of course, a lot of people are much more practitioners, and I'm not much of a practitioner. I'm a book person. I see dead people, you know, all the old authors.
And you have created innovative ways to share what you're discovering and reading and publishing. And I want to talk about that in a moment and ask you some more questions. But this translation discussion is fascinating for me because I have tried to take classes and it's been challenging, I think, for most people to make the time for it, especially if you're practicing full time. You have to the time. And then there's this whole issue I discovered with interpretation. So it's not like a character automatically translates into a specific English language concept. There's one character can have a few different interpretations.
Yeah,
depending on.
True.
Yeah. So that's why I'm curious about the whole process of independent study versus being in a class with, you know, more rules and deadlines and homework and stuff like that, you know.
Part of the problem is, like, I'm an impatient person and I always do things too quickly. Other people are very meticulous, and being fast or being slow doesn't mean being smarter or less smart. It doesn't mean being better or less good, but they're just people who by nature are meticulous, and then there are people who by nature just do it the quick and dirty way and it's good enough. And I'm like more of the do it the quick and dirty way and get it done type person than I should be, then is good for me. So if I took classes at this point, I'd just be so bored and so impatient, and I just want to cut to the chase. So for me, I think it was good to find passages and that interested me so that even from the start, I was getting stuff out of it rather than just doing exercises. But this way also means that my grammar is less good and I'm going to make certain types of errors from being too sloppy.
So do you remember when you started, what text you began, what medical text you started reading?
I don't remember really what I first started with, but very early I liked Zhang Jiebin, who wrote, he was a Ming Dynasty doctor. He died in 1640 and wrote a lot of really big books. And I didn't have, in the beginning, I wasn't trying to translate a book. I was just trying to find a passage here or a passage there that was interesting. I love Huang Di Neijing, you know, Ling Xiu and Su Wen. So I've been playing in that for a long time, but I know my time period is not the Han Dynasty 2000 years ago. The time period that I mostly like what they're saying and can more or less understand what they're doing and feel like it influences the way I view medicine, this is the Ming Dynasty, which began in 1368 and ended in 1644. And so I've spent a lot of time with a number of different Ming Dynasty doctors. And, you know, Chinese has changed over the dynasties. So you get used to the language that tended to be used in a certain time period, and then you're less good at reading works from other time periods, either before or after. So I guess my interest in Neijing has, as I understand it now, like, of course, any Ming Dynasty doctor would have studied Neijing. And so I actually care more about how Ming Dynasty people would read Neijing than I care about how Han Dynasty people would read it, if that makes any sense. Because since all the doctors I translate would read it, I want to understand it the way the doctors I translate understand it, because it influenced them.
And have you found that that there is a difference and that there are particular things you can pull out from Ming Dynasty physicians who read Neijing versus Han Dynasty?
Well, one thing, I know you know this, but some of the listeners may not. On Facebook, there's some groups like Scholars of Chinese Medicine, which you really can bring up some topic from Neijing and discuss it and whatever. And one of the things that we've been discussing lately, and I think is important to understand, is that when Neijing was written, it was much more channel-based and not all the points were in it. And even some things that are point names today were probably regions in Neijing. And so if Chuipun, which is the name of stomach 12 in Neijing, meant the whole supraclavicular fossa and not the one particular point, but in the Ming Dynasty, they were more inclined to read it as the one particular point, which isn't how the Han Dynasty people saw it. I don't know if that's too weird a example, but...
Well, that's very helpful. I mean, it's really fascinating to discover these different ways of even looking at the statements in the books and how there are lots of different ways to interpret what's being said, and then to adapt for your own practice. So yeah, the ideas are interesting.
This is what happens, is we think we know stuff because we learned it in acupuncture school. And of course, this stuff is part of TCM style. But if I go back and read Ming Dynasty stuff or Han Dynasty stuff, knowing the things that I think I know now, I'm going to misinterpret, because the same term may have had different implications at that time, may refer to something else at that time. And so one of the things that's really been hard to learn is, like, kind of to strip away the things I think I know now and try and only know the things that, say, the Ming Dynasty doctor would know for that period of that I'm translating that. So it's kind of like creating a virtual Ming Dynasty mind, as opposed to using my 21st century mind when I read. it's imperfect. It's not that I can really do it, but otherwise you make errors by reading in things that they didn't actually say, but it seems similar enough to what you learned in school. So then you see it through that colored glass.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I imagine when you're teaching, you have to, especially if you're teaching doctoral students who've already gone through a TCM program, everybody has to start with a completely wiped slate, completely new foundation. And you must spend time talking about just Ming Dynasty period conditions and history before you even start teaching the medicine. Is that right?
Well, it depends, because if what you're teaching is a class for people who are primarily practitioners, what you want to do is make it usable. It's more important to make it usable for these students than for them to be anthropologists and historians. And so there are limits to how much I emphasize that stuff. Sometimes it's important and sometimes it's not really important for their purposes. But I taught a class this weekend in Emperor's College DAOM, and the class was supposed to be on the classics of Chinese medicine, and it could be like any topic I wanted within that. And two days ago, whenever it was, I called the class overall data mining ancient Chinese medical texts, because that's what we really need to do, is bring forward stuff that's been forgotten but is still very useful and will enhance our practice. I spent the morning talking about how did they practice acupuncture, moxibustion, bleeding in the Ming Dynasty. Not so much because I wanted them to practice that way, but we just kind of assume that ancient treatments look the same as modern treatments, and we have a particular style. And if the style works on if you get good results for 80% of your patients, that's great. 90%, that's great. But what about the 10% that you're not getting such good results? Maybe using a different style is beneficial. So I tried to talk about the things that I gleaned from case studies and various texts from back then, just to kind of give them, I wish I could be a fly on the wall when a Ming Dynasty doctor was doing an acupuncture treatment and just see exactly how he interacted and how he came up with a diagnosis and how he, and I keep saying he because they were really mostly he, how they inserted the needle, how long did they retain the needle. And just to give you one example, in the Ming Dynasty books, needle retention was listed in number of breaths, like this point retained for 3 breaths, that point retained for 7 breaths. That is so different when we think everybody needs about 30 minutes of needle retention. And the relevancy is that if you think every patient needs 30 minutes of needle retention, well, acupuncture must have worked in ancient times, because we wouldn't be practicing today if it was never effective, yet they only retained for less than 10 breaths. So needle retention is a style you can have, but also you're not bound by retaining the needle for 30 minutes, and there may be reasons to have shorter needle retention. They also had a lot more focus while they were needling than many practitioners today. So if you're putting it in and then taking 3 nice breaths, that's almost like doing qigong on every point. And yeah, so it was like the practice was quite different. And some of the things from that style, I think we could use today on certain patients, or certain doctors might like it.
Mm-hmm. So then what about with the use of moxa? And I know you had a period of time when you were doing a lot of research and teaching and writing about moxa.
The moxa stick was invented in the Ming Dynasty also. And in the Ming Dynasty, it was only used in special cases, certain cases. what they mostly did was either direct matzah, like grain of rice size, grain of wheat size, kind of like Japanese style today, or they did indirect matzah, like on ginger, on garlic, on salt, on futsa. And so this is one of the things I also like to do is, like in teaching matzah class, we spend a whole lot of time on indirect and direct matzah, because these are tools that I actually think are better delivery systems. If you hold a matzah stick over a point, most of the heat, most of the smoke, most of the chi rises up and away from the point, and it doesn't seem to penetrate very deep. And you have to stand there for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes with the matzah stick stinking up the room. It's very inefficient. But if you do a grain of rice, that really works well on putting matzah in a precise point. And, you know, indirect matzah on ginger or garlic also is like really quite wonderful. But when I went to school, I never once saw anyone do it. They just used stinky matzah stick. Hopefully the schools are better today. and so I joke that I boycott matzah sticks, which isn't 100% true.
I do too. A lot of my disposable income goes to matzah, not to me. I use a lot of indirect matzah. And when I can practice, I'll use more direct matzah. But a treatment doesn't feel complete without it to me. But
I'm on your team.
So from matzah, your interests have evolved. And I can understand based on what you said before about your curiosity and how you get bored after a while. But you do so much work now on making an external application of herbal therapies or herbal formulation. And it's wonderful. At least on the Facebook group I can see in the discussion the growing interest. So it's not just you posting, it's other people jumping in and talking about their own experimentation with making external herbs.
That was another thing I never saw any of when I was in school. Of course, I was in school from 86 to 88. And so some schools are doing better and other schools, you don't get that at all in when you're a student. And I think these things like matzah or making medicine, if you don't see it when you're a student, most people aren't going to try and figure it out later. Most people need to have somebody show them before they even think it's possible. So people buy like ointments from Chinatown that are made with Vaseline. I think Vaseline's so gross. anyway, so I just started like in translate. Okay, so one of the things I found in translating is sometimes it's hard to pick the right English word when you've never seen the thing be done. And so this started with my translation of matzah stuff, is that there were things and it's like, well, gee, do I use this word or that word when you're, you know, making matzah floss? Do you pound it or do you grind it? And so I started just trying stuff to find so that I could then select the right word in English for the translation. And after I started trying to do stuff, I found I really liked it. So then after that, I started data mining for stuff that I could experiment with. Mostly, I want stuff that could be usable today. Occasionally, I play with stuff that I wouldn't do on anyone but myself. Yeah, I experiment on me all the time.
What's your favorite thing to make?
My favorite thing is to always find something new. Yeah, I'm a Gemini snake.
What's the last formula you tried or last application you tried that you loved? And how, I mean, do you like to make really challenging things that have to have be prepared, have take lots of preparation and processing, or do you like quick and easy?
I like to try and find the original way of doing something, and then sometimes I try to make it more user-friendly. So for example, syrups, which are called gao, ointments are also gao, but let's say you wanted to make a cough syrup with pipaye. Oh, the original recipes have you boil it three times and then you combine the three liquids from the three times you boiled it and then you simmer it down for a very long period of time. And each of those original three boilings is for like 2 hours. And then you, the combined liquid from three boilings, you boil down for another long time to make it highly condensed. And then you add honey to it and then you simmer it down some more. And I know some of the listeners will say simmer honey, but this is what the old books have you do. And like, nobody's going to do that today. Nobody except me. But I like, one of the things I've been experimenting with in the last year is like making these kinds of things in the Instant Pot, you know, pressure cooking. Like if ancient doctors had had a pressure cooker, they would have used it. They didn't have a pressure cooker, so they did things, you know, more involved in harder way. And so now I can make syrups in using the Instant Pot that are virtually the same as syrups that were cooked the original way in, you know, one morning, what used to take 2 days to make. So yeah, this kind of stuff.
And the originators of these formulas, the doctors, would be so thrilled with the way you're teaching. Because it's not like you're making it so accessible with your Facebook groups, with the photos and the graphic written directions you take the time to make. It's really wonderful.
Well, thanks. I mean, it's obsession, but that's okay. It's better than my old obsessions from the ancient past.
Oh, well. If you want to tell some of those, you can, no. But you don't have to.
I was like, as a teenage and 20-year-old person, I was like, not the same person. I was into a lot of stuff, but that was ancient history. So now I turn my obsessions towards more beneficial things.
And you teach in the schools around Los Angeles. So do you take these same methods and teach these in classes? What classes are you teaching?
I teach a lot of the regular required classes, which sometimes are, you know, just didactic, blah, 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 blah. But I also have a Moxa elective, which I teach once a year at Emperor's College, and I teach occasionally at another school. And I just this summer created a medicine making elective. This week will be the 8th week of class. It's 10 weeks. And every week we make something different in class, very hands on. And people get to try it in class or take it home if it's something like an ointment where you end up with product. And so it's a lot of fun. I really like these classes, but I have to take half my kitchen in the car with me to class. It's fun.
Oh, that sounds great. And then for those of us who aren't local, you show us how to make things in with your Facebook group, and there's still discussion where people can talk about what they've made and how they did it and show photos and everything. It's really wonderful.
Yeah. So I have this Facebook page called Medicine Making where I take photos. I make photo albums like a do-it-yourself. How do you make this? How do you make that? How do you make honey pills? How do you make water pills? How do you make Bao He Wan? How do you make ointments? How do you make syrups and so forth? And then there's also a discussion group called Making Chinese Medicinals, which I started, but I don't process everything myself. People have their own discussions and I participate or not, depending on the topic. So I've really, you know, I've said earlier, I don't understand humans and I don't really post a lot of personal stuff on Facebook, but I like using it as a way to kind of publish how do you do this or little bits of translation or something like that.
Yeah, I resonate with that totally. So when you were translating some of the books that you did for Chinese Medicine Database, I guess the book,
the Raising the Dead book, the book on emergency medicine, did that spark some of your interest or feed your interest in the external, in the medicine making?
Yes, but I already was interested before that. I have some Dieda medicine or Shanka, which is traumatology, and especially Dieda is like martial arts traumatology. Shanka might be more general, like just anybody, somebody falls off a horse or whatever and gets injured. I was interested in that for a long time, and I've translated, you know, a couple of books, but they're not so publishable for various reasons. And so I've been looking at this and playing with this stuff for a while, but it just came to a point where I put more of my focus onto it. And yeah, that book, Raising the Dead, is from a Qing Dynasty, much larger book. It's excerpts about emergency medicine and how to treat various stuff. And since it's excerpts, I had two criteria for that. Either it had to be useful today or it had to be strange and interesting. But I also had exclusion criteria. So if it wasn't useful and it wasn't interesting and if it was toxic, or there is some stuff that we would consider cruelty to animals, so I didn't put that stuff in. But that's a fun book. I mean, there's a lot of strange stuff in there, as well as useful stuff.
Yeah. But my favorite book from the many wonderful translations that you've done for the database is The Miscellaneous Records of a Female Doctor. The Ming Dynasty physician, Dr. Tang.
Yeah, she... So Charlotte Firth...
She grabbed you.
She did grab me.
And said, do my book.
Charlotte Firth is a historian of Chinese medicine and of gender issues. She's not a practitioner. She's a retired professor from USC. She wrote a book called A Flourishing Yin. And she had discovered this one tiny little book in a rare books library in Beijing. And it was, you know, this book written by this woman doctor in the 1500s, and it was like 20 some case studies or maybe 30 case studies that she wrote about her patients, and she only treated women, but women loved coming to her because there were a lot of etiquette, you know, things, and so women were not so comfortable with male doctors. Even today, I'd rather have a female doctor. And so women really flocked to her because there weren't very many. Of course, there might be grannies who, you know, had folk healing methods, but she had studied with her grandparents who were both doctors. Her grandmother and her grandfather were both literate doctors, and she was literate, and she read all the texts that a male doctor would have studied at the time. And Charlotte Firth had given me a copy, like a photocopy of this book, actually a few years before, and it just sat in my closet until one day I just wanted to look at it. And it just, she just really, you know, it's like she grabbed me. You're right. She grabbed hold of me, and I just was compelled to keep working on it. And I just like actually experienced so much emotional stuff while I was going through it too. It's
like,
so first off, let me say, if all you want is like how to treat this and how to treat that, it's not the best book for that. I really think there's not a huge amount that people can take home to use in their practice, but I've translated a lot of case studies from male doctors and then her case studies. And she just had so much more rapport with patients and so much more, I don't know, like she could feel what they were feeling. And she just treated them, I don't know, it's just so different than when male doctors talk about female patients in the old books. There's just something special about it. And she really kind of felt like she was on a mission, and I don't know, I just like had to complete that and get that done. And that's, I think, the favorite book I've ever done, although I don't think it's the clinically most relevant book I've ever done.
Oh, I feel it's very clinically relevant. It was very helpful for me to read and get a sense of how her understanding of women's health spanned a lifetime, and in the lifetime of the patients, not just when they were having children or after, or when they were, you know, young women beginning their menstrual life. No, there are cases that are applicable for a woman's whole life. And that was very helpful for me in the detail. She's paid a lot of attention to detail in her patients and took that into account when she was considering their cases.
It's true. Her cases are longer than a lot of the male's cases. She gives a little more of the background. In the male cases, they might just say the woman was upset and had trouble with anger, and this is her diagnosis, and here's what I did. But she would explain how the husband has been doing this or that, and you just get more of a feeling for the life of the woman, like she actually cared about the whole woman and not just her condition.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, this book is a wonderful contribution. I highly recommend it. So is there another book project you're working on, or you're focusing on your teaching right now?
This year, 2018, I made 3 new continuing education classes, and all of them are like very much hands-on, like external medicine was one, making pills and powders and syrups was another, and medicinal incense was another. And then I taught this class in the DAOM for the first time, and I'm teaching the medicine making elective for the first time. So this year it's been focusing maybe on turning things into classes. So I've been translating a lot, but it's just data mining, like finding a recipe and translating it or something like that. So I need to get, I told you I work on obsession. I need to get obsessed with the next thing.
When you're done with this, I guess. You're just starting all this.
I am thinking about writing a book on medicine making, but I don't know if I can do that or not, because actually, just like there's food science and there's certain things you have to know, like in order to bake good bread, or you could bake good bread by following recipes or by lots of experience, but there's also like food science, there's like medicine making science, and I don't know enough of it, and I have to decide if I want to learn a little more or if I don't want to bother with that stuff. Mm-hmm. To give an example, a straightforward example is like to make a liniment, you need at least 40% alcohol, but not too high a percent. If you buy some alcohol that only has 16%, it won't stay preserved. And so you have to know certain things in order to make the product come out and be preserved the way you want it to be. And so I don't know all this stuff.
But I guess you have to be willing to try things out and have them work or not work. And then if they don't work, to try again, right? Then that's...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I've made so many messes in my kitchen, and some I've had, you know, failures. I've also had things that are not bad the first try, but the second try I can make them better.
And you have to be able to get the ingredients you want, right? Especially with the herbs.
Fortunately, living in Los Angeles, I can find most things. There are plenty of Chinese grocery stores to get baijiu, the you know, liquor that they would have used for liniments, or huangzhou, the liquor that they use in powder in processing herbs, you know, and then there are lots of herb stores here. And I also order from Spring Wind or from various places.
Mm-hmm. So the two questions I had, and I can ask them separately, but I'm really curious about, after 30 years, any insight you have to share about your longevity, the longevity of your commitment and interest and love for the medicine, and anything you want to say about that might be helpful for someone else who's been practicing half as long and is committed and loves it, but just not sure about how long they can do it.
For me, I think this may have to do with different people's personality types, but I'm just always curious and I just always like to keep learning and never doing the same thing for too long. So the thing I found about Chinese medicine is you could study your whole life and still keep going deeper and still keep learning more. And so for me, the key is always finding something new and exciting that keeps me involved. But, you know, I don't personally care if it's clinically applicable. I like knowledge just for the sake of knowledge. But there's this other kind of person who's a much better doctor who really wants to know what works and doesn't want to waste brain cells on intellectual things that, you know, aren't clinically relevant. And so, you know, for that kind of person, I don't really know what to say because that's a different kind of person. But just keeping going deeper or going down different paths and discovering different things, and it's endless and it's wonderful and it's profound and it's beautiful. And Chinese medicine can be so poetic and so connected, not only holistic in terms of the body, but holistic in your relationship with heaven and earth above and below you. And so I do love having a philosophical medicine. So I just pursue the philosophy, the culture, and the medicine itself.
And do you find yourself, in when you're teaching, do you teach to kind of present what you have to clinicians, or do you try to influence and encourage their interest in something more? Because to me, the two together is just, I mean, there's just nothing like it. To have that philosophical foundation and historical foundation in tradition, and know that what you're doing may have been done 500, 600 years ago, but it's applicable today, and still be dedicated to helping your patients. I mean, there's just nothing like that.
Yeah, totally.
But I do know there's a lot of practitioners who just want to get it done. And I understand.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those people. So do you find yourself trying to influence people who are just mostly dedicated to getting results in clinical practice? Or you just do your thing and put it out there, and who can grab onto it can run with it?
You know, I have people who really resonate with me, and I have people who don't, and that's okay. Because there are plenty of people who are treating, you know, teaching the more Western science view of Chinese medicine. There are plenty of people who are teaching herbs based on lab work or on the chemical components of the herbs. There are plenty of people who are teaching acupuncture based on much more the physical anatomy. And I think we need that too. I think we need both threads. And so I'm not a person in the middle of the road that likes to focus on both aspects. I'm just really on one end of the spectrum. And when I teach in two schools, you know, the entry level basic theories or fundamentals class. And I really do try to express some of the beauty and poetry of the philosophy and the way the ancient Chinese looked at the body and how that's different than the way modern people do. Because I know they'll get, most of the teachers are a little bit more on the integrated sciencey side of it. And so I just feel that my part is like balancing it a little bit more towards, don't forget our ancient roots. But I still have to cover what's on the state board. You know, I still have to cover this stuff that they need to know.
But it's so good that you know that you have a clear definition of what you're doing, and that there's still room for other perspectives. You're not going around arguing with people.
I argue plenty.
I was getting ready to say, I do know from some Facebook discussions that you don't tolerate making stuff up, people making stuff up, that there it has to be sourced.
Yeah. And also, you know, I mean, I'm a little bit like this just naturally. And it's like I've just decided that I'm not going to let anybody step over me or mansplain me or make me be smaller than I am. So I can be a little bit argumentative or something just because I'm not going to be like a sweet little female that anybody can push around. There's so many of the famous teachers are males in our profession, yet so many of the practitioners are women. So I just somehow want to try and represent so I get back in people's faces.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Have you seen or experienced progress from 1989 and 1990 to, 2018 in terms of opportunities women can create for themselves in this profession?
Yeah, that too. I think with the internet, it's so much more of a level playing field because anybody can put themselves out there and then you just see who gets followings and stuff like that. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I definitely think there are more women teachers now than there used to be, and that's a good thing. Women lecturers and, women who are important in the field. And, I also hope people of color can get more respect in the field as well. And it's funny, not funny, how a lot of our history's been covered over. For example, for all the attention I've paid to history, I never heard about Mutulu Shakur until a year and a half ago or something like that. And he was one of the early acupuncture pioneers in the U.S. and, African-American. And why did I never hear of this before?
Good point. So are the doctoral programs now that are being offered way different from the program you went through?
Yeah, what I had was a PhD, and then these programs are doctoral. So technically a doctoral is supposed to be more clinically oriented, more practice oriented, whereas a PhD is a little more academically oriented, not quite so much focused on the clinical practice of medicine. And so, yeah, it's a lot different.
Mm-hmm, I understand. I feel like there's so much to learn. I'm still trying to find the time to pursue my interests. So I don't really want to go through somebody's program where they tell me what to do. I just want to study on my own. And I think you're a real trailblazer for me for that example you set, that it can be done.
You totally specialize, though. I mean, you've been able to at least pursue your interests deeply in one area. I don't know. Do you have new interests now? Something else you want to do instead?
Well, I've been trying to learn how to read Chinese, medical Chinese. And I got overwhelmed in a class I was taking, so I couldn't grasp. So I just, every time I sat down to do it, I felt this overwhelming frustration. But I miss it because I liked learning how to write the characters and learning what they mean. And so I've got to, try to figure out a different way to do it. I wasn't grasping it. So I thought, Michael said maybe I need to go somewhere and just learn the basic vocabulary and basic grammar. And I know with Pleco, I can learn how to write the strokes.
I can't write the strokes. I don't know stroke order. I'm so, like I told you, I do quick and dirty. So there's some characters I can write, but I know it's totally in the wrong order and totally ugly because my handwriting's ugly in English too. But you should pick something that might be useful to you, like a formula that you want to know the original, way it was written about. And formulas do not have a lot of grammar. You know, it like lists symptom, comma, symptom, comma, symptom, you know, treats this, 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 and that, and then use this herb so many grams, and then cook, add water and cook it until it's 70%. You know, it's really very formulaic in terms of the grammar. And once you've translated five formulas, it becomes like really pretty easy. So then you have the ability to just go search for a formula and see if you get a different perspective from reading the original.
Oh, I appreciate that. That's so great, because I really want to have this as part of my own personal practice to be able to read. And, you know, I missed not being able to keep up with the class, but it was just over my head. It was just too much.
Yeah. So formulas, individual herbs, or points are relatively easy in terms of grammar, and you could start having insights almost right away.
Oh, Lorraine, that's such a good idea. That sounds like something I can do. And it means so much that 4 decades later, I'm still able to be inspired by your work and your teaching and your scholarship. And so it's just been wonderful to hear about all you're doing and your development, and I look forward to hearing more. Thank you.